the world is created by the characters within the world to some extent, right?
Just like flying in on a broomstick and shooting lightning out of your hands, it's like it's very different feel from, okay, if I want to do this, if I want this outcome, I'm going to have to pay like a price that is going to be equivalent.
A lot of people have gotten tired of Westerns, so it's like, what can you do? What is different?
Hello, and welcome to the Worldcraft Club podcast, a show designed to help writers, game masters, and storytellers of all stripes to create rich, immersive worlds for their audience to get lost in time and time again. Here with me today is Clay Boone, author of Where the Shadows Are the Darkest, a Weird West historical fantasy? Horror? Is fantasy the right word? You tell me. You wrote it.
Well, I had a real hard time trying to categorize the genre, because as far as I know, it is kind of Weird West, I guess is the best way to put it. There are some horror aspects. Grimdark. I always say it's a grimdark Western with some fantasy.
Yes, that captures it well. Yeah. So in fact, to get us started here, that's a nice vague introduction to the genre. But why don't you give us sort of your elevator pitch? Like, how would you sell this book to somebody?
So it takes place in the ashes of Reconstruction era in Missouri, which, if you guys don't know, that is where the bloodiest battles of the Civil War were fought, on the Missouri-Kansas border. So what's happening is there's a young boy, teenager, whose father has a clouded past and his mother doesn't want to talk about it. So he goes out searching for it, and there's a washed up demon hunter out there as well, who knows his father, and he's trying to get his retirement check basically from hunting demons when this boy shows up. So it's mud, blood, and swamp water. It's definitely not for children. It delves into the aspects of the Reconstruction era and the American Civil War, American history in general. And as for the magic in the story, okay, so let's think of real life, whether you're a believer or you're not. A prayer can be answered, won't be answered. Magic, on the other hand, you take a cult, you have to give something. So in the occult, the belief is that demons gain power in the world by taking something from you. So maybe it's like a chair or a doll. They get a little more power when they get that. Or maybe it's, you know, you have to do something for them. But that is how they get their power. And then in return, they give you some kind of power. So the magic used, it takes something from the user. Okay, so when you use it, you might lose your mind. You might go into a coma. It might lash out. You might lose control of it. But I didn't want it to be like some guy flying around on a broomstick shooting lightning out of his fingers. I wanted you to feel it. Like, the important thing about Where Shadows Are the Darkest, I wanted you to feel the characters, the world they lived in, what they were experiencing, and what they had to pay to get what they wanted.
Yeah, and I think that came through really well. It was funny, just after having listened to your book, I watched The Princess and the Frog, the last 2D animated Disney movie. And it was just funny. Are you familiar with that one?
No. I've seen the animations.
Yeah. It was just, it was funny because there was this very, they were totally different from your book, but at the same time, there were these fun similarities where the main villain, that's really his story, is like how much he's giving up to have the power he has. And he kind of brings other people into that same game with him. And so it was, you know, he's like a voodoo guy. There were these real, like, and a lot of it takes place in the, like, the swamps of Louisiana. So there was just this, like, there were all these interesting touch points, whereas, like, you know, while your book was very different, some of these things do come up. In fact, I think that that's just, it's a reality of that sort of darker magic, is that price paid to get a piece of it. It's something that I know I've noodled with some some of my work as well. And I think that's a really good way to do magic. 'Cause like you say, like, And not to criticize the world of Harry Potter, it's very fun, but that just like flying in on a broomstick and shooting lightning out of your hands, it's like, it's very different feel from, okay, if I want to do this, if I want this outcome, I'm going to have to pay like a price that is going to be equivalent.
Right.
And I think that's a, yeah, I think that's a, it really tamps down the magic in the world so that every like level 5 adventurer isn't just casting fireball at every problem that comes their way.
Right. And it's only a select few that know how to truly harness it.
Right. And not because necessarily that it's, I mean, the knowledge might be difficult to get a hold of, but it also just the cost of it and the reality of what you're doing is going to push a lot of people away from it. And so
right.
I think there's multiple archetypes that you'll find in there. There's the sort of Faustian archetype that is like really after worldly gain. And I think you've done something interesting with that kind of character. But I don't want to spoil anything. And I think there's also just sort of the, like the dedicated sorcerer who that's just their life is delving into this stuff. And they seem to be attracted to it for its own sake. But yeah, I was definitely drawn in pretty quickly. I love a good Western. I love, you know, the sort of fantasy and sci-fi high adventure type stories. And this clicked both of those boxes in a nice way. But with that, I will kick it over back to you to talk about what some of your influences were, what made you want to write a story in this sort of setting.
While I was writing this fantasy, I was like, you know what? Like, okay, there's tons of Westerns. Usually it's like a railroad magnate, a bank robbery, a mysterious stranger, a border war, something like that. Okay, so I grew up watching John Wayne films, and I'm a huge fan of Clint Eastwood and other movies, but it's kind of, and I hate to say it because I have friends who've written Westerns, but, and I'm not saying it for these people, but I'm saying a lot of people have gotten tired of Westerns. So it's like, what can you do? What is different? I wanted to have that gothic dark feel, but I wanted it more anchored in history than fantasy, if that makes sense. And if you read about history and just the time period, it's already horrifying. Let's draw it into the history. So during that time, during the American Civil War, they have the seminary schools, right? So during the war, the seminary split in theology. So the views on like man being higher than other men and, you know, white men were the ordained. Okay.
Yeah.
That was one side of it. And the other side was like, God is trying to free you from the chains. The other side is like, you're kind of a slave to your sin kind of thing. So I was able to draw onto that. And then I went down deeper into the rabbit hole. Okay, so how can we put demons into it but make it sound realistic? So it took me down the rabbit hole of Judeo-Christianity, demons and angels. So a lot of this I didn't use in my book, but this is part of the part that I enjoy. I really enjoy digging. So I dig deep. Let's start with the angels. There's different races of angels. The lowest form are kind of watchers, and they help us down here on Earth. There's other ones who have never even came down to Earth. All right? They have different, they all serve different purposes. And according to the Judeo-Christian beliefs, okay, when Lucifer fell, he took his angels. And in theory, what happened is the angels became inversions of themselves. So they became the dark versions of themselves. Okay. So then, and then I started thinking, so if these beings are beings of darkness, of complete chaos and evil and hatred, wouldn't they fight amongst one another? And this is where I kind of disagreed with the theology a little bit. So according to the Judeo-Christian beliefs, everything is preordained. So they can only do certain things. They kind of act as lawyers, which makes sense. But if you look on the occult side, which is the other side that I put into the book, because that also existed in that time, they believe that these dark entities fight amongst one another. which makes a lot of sense, because if they're beings of envy and chaos and jealousy, wouldn't, I doubt, you know, Moloch would be happy if Beelzebub got more power than him, right? Even if it is a lateral move, like, wouldn't they fight amongst one another? You know, wouldn't they have feuds with one another?
So seems reasonable.
I took all these aspects and I turned it up to an 11, or maybe even, I think that's one of the reasons I chose this era, these people, because you take Civil War history, there's so many things about it. And it's always like, okay, these guys wanted the slaves, these guys were freeing the slaves, and then they play the patriotic music with their beard extensions, you know, like God and generals. And I, coming from Missouri, my family was in the South. Two of my great-great-grandfathers were shot for being raiders. And going into that, okay? So if you lived on the Kansas-Missouri border during the war was much more personal, because you had these irregular troops that were going on both sides of the border, killing people, taking people prisoner, robbing people, just taking complete advantage of the war. And to Bloody Bill Anderson, he was one of the most evil of all of them. But you look at his backstory, okay? What happened is the Northerner Raiders came in, the Jayhawkers, and all the women, they took them. If you were associated with Confederates, they took them. Men generally in that time weren't spared. If you were 12 and older, you either got conscripted or shot. So what happened to Bloody Bill Anderson? His sisters were taken to the prison. The prison collapsed, killed them, maimed multiple others. And what happened after that was Quantrill, who was a school teacher, he was only 24 years old, rounded up these boys and a lot of men. And the Lawrence Massacre happened right on the border. So, you know, you take all these things and you've got a grim, dark novel, you know, like you don't have to look too far within human history to find a grim, dark novel. It writes itself.
That's very true, yeah. I found your characters, like just about every one of them was sympathetic. Certainly they all had sympathetic reasons for their actions, for their character. Some more forgivable than others. You did give characters motives and reasons for how they acted that could be understood on some level, even if their actions were inexcusable.
Well, that was my most important part of my book. I kept asking my beta reader and my editor, like, how are the characters? How are the characters? Because unfortunately, the Western genre suffers from that tropey stereotype, like, oh, here's the man coming, bring law into the dusty tank, you know? And I really wanted to stay away from that, or the kind of characters that, like, oh, I'm the sad guy who did a lot of terrible things, and now I'm gonna, like, it's just, I really wanted them to be unique, but understandable, and I don't know. I delve a lot into the psychology of the characters. Like, okay, if this happened to him, how would he compensate?
Mm-hmm.
Because typically when we have some kind of yearn inside of us or need inside of us, we compensate in an unconscious way, and that develops as part of our personality. And so when I would create these characters, I would say, okay, this is what made him, this is what set him on this trajectory. What did he do with it? What did it make him? You know, did it turn him this way or this way? Why? And that was my most important thing. And one other thing was I didn't want it to be like a sulky type. So I put a lot of like dark comedy, and they kind of like play around with each other. And I don't know.
Yes.
You know,
I think also there was just and as I could do a whole video about my relationship to the word cozy, but for simplicity's sake, there are some cozy moments. Like there are, it feels more real because there are moments of just actual enjoyment. There are moments of natural beauty. There are moments of just real humanity between characters. Like, those are the kinds of stories that I can accept the grim dark when it's like there is, when it's not so nihilistic that there is no, you know, that everything is taken and nothing is redeemable. And I think that that's, you know, I think some of those open questions about how redeemable some of your characters are is a lot of what makes it, makes them characters that are interesting to read about. It keeps them from being flat in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
I'm a big proponent of characters. Like, this is obviously, this is a world building Worldcraft Club. This is a world building, enterprise we have here. But like, in my opinion, without characters that I can get attached to in some way or another, what interest do I have in the world? It's just a really interesting Wikipedia page. You've got the kind of orphan kid. Now he's not truly an orphan, right? His mother's alive. But you know, you've got the sort of the orphan poor farm boy kind of kid that's got to learn more about the world. And you've got the washed up gunslinger, but I think it's the, you know, it's the devil's in the details and so are the characters. Like, and I think it's the specifics, right? It's the ticks they have. It's the way you present the story that keeps it from just being a collection of tropes, and turns it into something that is memorable.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, because we are proponents of tropes here at the Worldcraft Club. You know, we're proponents of tropes being used well.
Right, that is the main thing.
Yeah, I mean, to divert for a moment, but just to kind of go down that particular rabbit trail, it's been interesting to me. So I've got three young kids. They watch all kinds of TV. I'm a child at heart, and I will watch cartoons with the best of them. But two things that my kids have watched in recent times are the Lego Bionicle show that came out, I don't know how many years ago.
That was a classic back in the day.
Okay, yeah, and Lego Ninjago, which is ongoing, but it's been around for a long time. It's funny though, because like, I am old enough that I was a huge Bionicle fan when I was in the target audience. I am too young for, or I'm too old for Ninjago. And insofar as when it came out, I was past my prime Lego buying days, no longer getting the Lego magazine. But what was interesting to me was, despite that fact that I have more nostalgic bias towards Bionicle, as I watched that show, I saw canned dialogue. I saw just really, I'm sure some people that were involved in that project, it was a passion project for them, but they weren't given the time or budget or whatever it was. And the dialogue was not good. The storytelling was really flat. And I could just walk right out of the room. I was like, I don't care that it's Bionicle. I have no investment in what's going on. And on the other hand, Ninjago, like, I am shocked by how interested I am in what is going on. The level of storytelling and that the attention paid to dialogue, the attention paid to characters, the relationships between characters,
right,
creating interesting villains, like, it just made me want to watch it, even though, you know, there are just these moments where it's like one character's angry, and so it just zooms in on their fist and they clench it, but it's just a little Lego hand. So it's just like a C that curls in on itself. And you're like, why am I watching this? But, you know, this is just little Lego figures, like, being tossed at each other. But like, I think that really speaks volumes just about like the value of good storytelling.
Oh yeah, for sure. And I mean,
yeah,
the world is created by the characters within the world to some extent, right? So, I mean, in theory, there's people within your world somewhere doing something that causes your world to be the way it is. I think, for me, the biggest influence that opened my eyes to the true value of characters was Joe Abercrombie's First Law series. Wonderful series. Okay. The characters are fantastic. And there's like dark comedic moments that happen and just like heart-wrenching moments where you've been with this character for three books and something terrible happens. Like, no! Why? Yeah.
I know that I know the name. I have not actually read any of his work. But yeah, I that's another thing that I think is really important is like is having sort of the emotional space to heighten things. And I think that that's something again that like there's a cat in the background now. So that's fun. But for again, like I think it's part of what turns me off, and not to pick on Warhammer, it's a really
Well, Warhammer is kind of cartoon. Like, it's there to sell the figure.
Oh yeah, right, absolutely, yeah. Like the ultimate at the end of the day, Games Workshop is trying to sell you overpriced plastic, and they're doing a great job. But you know, like what is difficult about a completely grimdark universe is that like you don't have space to have those gut-wrenching emotional moments. Like you don't you don't have the like you don't have the same register. So like in your story, the highs can be very, very high and the lows can be very, very low. And like there's just more room to play. It's like it keeps it from being monotone. And I think that's just so important. Like I think, you know, there's the same thing in like The Lord of the Rings where like there really are some very grim dark moments, especially if you get into like the extent, like the Silmarillion has some of the darkest stuff. Like, yeah, some of that feels like it was pulled straight out of Warhammer lore. The difference is the Shire still exists. Like, you know, like the difference is like there still is this beautiful countryside and these beautiful places and these, now what is the cat doing?
What are you doing? Whenever I wrote, like, for instance, Samuel, I pulled a lot of inspiration from Huck Finn. I wanted it.
Okay.
When I started it out, I wanted it to sound kind of like almost like a period piece, if that makes sense. Like the way he talks, the life he's living, he thinks. I wanted him to feel kind of like a Huck Finn. And then I was just going to kind of like drag him through the mud, which is kind of what I did, and watch how he develops into a man, you know? And and you can't have Huck Finn without that magic that he brought to the page. I mean, he was a Missouri guy as well. And the way he described the nature and the things he was doing through that lens of childhood innocence, it really helped me kind of write Samuel into the story, you know, amongst.
Yeah. And that's a great point too. Like that brings up sort of the contrast between Tom Sawyer and Huck Finn, right? Because Huck Finn is like the happy-go-lucky adventure hero. And Tom Sawyer had to go through a lot more stuff.
Right.
And I think the fact that you chose to make a Tom Sawyer rather than a Huck Finn really had an effect on the development of the character and the way he experienced and showcased the world. Yeah, I think that's great. Like that's a really good point. I think there's a lot of value in doing Tom Sawyer characters if you want like to really explore a world. I like that a lot. And again, it's like, and it really does come down to a matter of like, what are you trying to do with your world? Because like Huck Finn is probably a lot more likely to sell a bunch of comic books, to sell a Saturday morning cartoon, which again, like that, no problem with that at all. But like a Huck Finn or a Tom Sawyer type character is just going to be a whole lot better for something that dives a little deeper and something that, you know, can really elevate your storytelling. You want to see that kind of growth and like that doesn't have to be, there doesn't have to be a hard divide between that and Saturday morning cartoons. Another property that we often talk about on here is Avatar: The Last Airbender, which I think does a good job of putting a lot of growth and exploration into a children's show. But yeah, I do think it is helped along by the fact that we really get to see the characters develop and go through some difficult things. And the same is true of Samuel. And I think that really does help us out because at the beginning, like he's not a demon hunter.
No.
He's no experience with demons, like just living a sort of normal life. And I think that really helps us as the reader, as the visitant, to learn the world with him.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I really wanted. Then he ends up with the Black Company, basically.
But yeah, he ends up with quite a cast of characters and some interesting ones at that. really complex characters, like you know, characters with strange juxtapositions in their own minds that really help sell them. And I think too, like, that would be a good segue there to talk a little bit about how you sort of developed factions and how some of these different groups, because you kind of glanced on it earlier, but I'd like to just dig a little bit deeper into how you had different factions playing off of each other. So like, maybe just give an idea of like, so who might be hunting demons and why.
Well, this one, I actually, you know, that saying, kill your pretties. I had a lot of expo dumping on this, but I cut it all out, fortunately, for whoever reads it. But I do have a lot of content. Hopefully I can implement it in the next one. So you have the seminaries.
Right.
And they're split. So you have the Southern Baptist, which are like the hoop and hollering typical Southerner church. Then you got the Northern Methodist. And I didn't add it to the book, but I added the fact that they carry swords and crossbows. What I didn't add was that they saw John Brown as a saint. So they named their swords the John Browns because they're going out to stick some Southerners, you know. And then you have the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. And if you recall, about 200-300 years before the American Civil War, I mean, that's the whole reason why the Mayflower came over, was to move the Protestants, because the Catholics and the Christians were fighting. So within the book, that rift was there. And just between the Catholic and the Christian community, part of my research was exorcisms. Who knows exorcisms better than the Catholic Church? The Protestants have their own ways of doing it, but it's not as ritualistic as the Catholic Church. So the Catholic
Church... Yeah, right. That's kind of their thing.
Yeah. So whenever the demons start ripping into the world, the Catholic Church starts making a killing, selling to the Protestants and these demon hunters for like different saintly objects and rituals and priests. So they begin gaining traction. And of course, the Protestant churches don't like that. All right. And this ties in because you have to remember, Spain didn't get removed from America, which is a Catholic country, Spain. They were still down in Florida. And before the American Civil War, we tried to remove them down there with the Seminole. And they armed the Seminole and kicked us out. And then we had another war down there. And after that, 300 still remain down there. But I'm getting kind of off topic. Ties into my story.
Right.
But we have...
Right, we could also talk about the tragic background of Old Hickory and whether his actions were excusable or not.
To
bring it full circle.
History. But but then you have the Luciferian side of it, and you have like the voodoo, which was part of it. I took different factions within the occult as well. So far I only have the voodoo side of it. I plan to add more, but all of what I added, I wanted to tie it into the depths of American culture, you know, and what might have existed back then. I tried my best to create it where it was like, if this really were to happen in that time period, what would the world look like? You know? Just after the American Civil War, tensions were still high. There were still bandits running around in the hollers. So it would have fractured the country even worse than it was already torn apart. And I tried to show that through the religious institutions and groups that existed.
Yeah. And it's sad to think that in the midst of, like, you know, demonic incursions, that we'd still be arguing about, you know, the kind of the relatively petty differences between some of the denominations. Not to dismiss all the differences between the denominations, but I think that, you know, you would hope that we could get together and talk about it without like the swords and crossbows at that point, but it's hard to say, man, isn't it?
That's the thing about a civil war. You know, you have a civil war, it's brother against brother, quite literally. The families are split, and you might be living next to somebody who killed your friend. You know, like,
yeah.
So you think about that, and you mix it all in a pot, and that's what you get. A spicy chili pot.
Yeah. Yeah. And it, yeah, I think I'm looking forward to the next book. I'm looking forward to exploring some of these factions and ideas further. Yeah. You really, I think you didn't develop the Baptists and the Methodists a whole lot, but you didn't have the time and space to, and you did it enough for us to get an idea of what they were doing. And I think that's really key. Like, that's one of our things here is, like, leaving blank spaces is a good thing, especially when you are trying to tell a specific story. Just kind of flagging something and being like, you know, these two factions have beef with each other. They're also not the focus of our story, so you're not going to get to hear that whole story here. I'm excited to see where it goes. And with that, I'd love to know where we can find your work, as well as what you're planning on doing next.
Well, Amazon and Audible, you can find them both on there. If you liked the book, or if you didn't, please make sure to leave a review. It helps me out and gives me some feedback for the second book. I'm currently working on the second book, and I will drop you guys a hint of what my research is currently. So if you were a plantation owner that somehow got a hold of a state penitentiary, you made it out with gold, because slavery never really ended if you had a state penitentiary.
I'm very excited to see your next book. I would encourage our audience to check out your current book. And like you said, can be found Amazon and Audible. I'm sure we will find a way to put a link so that everyone can see this. So in the meantime, everybody, thanks for coming along with us on this conversation. You can find us, well, you have found us here on YouTube or Spotify, wherever you did find us. And there should be links for finding us further as well. You can join us on Discord, come talk to us, comment on our videos, let us know how you think we're doing. And until next time, have a good one and keep crafting interesting worlds.